Welcome, everyone, to this, the fifth lecture in honour of Jocelyn Herbert, which makes it the halfway point in our series of 10 lectures sponsored by the Ritstein Hopkins Foundation and run in association between the University of the Arts London and the National Theatre. I'm Eileen Hogan, a professor of university and a trustee of Ritstein Hopkins, and I was lucky enough to know Jocelyn. I know some of you have been to all five lectures, which we're delighted about. We're also always very pleased to see so many students in the audience, alongside Jocelyn's family, colleagues and friends. Jocelyn's archive moved to the National Theatre from Wimbledon College of Arts about a year ago. Hers is the only full archive of an individual designer at the National. An excellent recent exhibition was made for the Littleton Lounge, amalgamating her material with items from the wider National Theatre Archive, curated by Natasha Bonilam and Erin Lee. It featured set, costume and mask designs and examined the processes underpinning Jocelyn's ideas, using her sketchbooks and correspondence with directors and writers. Especially apt was an introductory text by Mark Dakin, who was then technical director at the National. Jocelyn had great regard for a number of key National Theatre staff with whom she worked closely for many years, and they returned the compliment. This show came down to make way for the exhibition of a Limbury Prize for stage design, during which we were very anxious to schedule today's lecture. And Jocelyn's exhibition returns in the new year and will be there to the end of January. Students on our MA and Curating and Collections course have used Jocelyn's archive extensively this year, curating an exhibition at Wimbledon called Jocelyn Herbert and Samuel Beckett, which married well with the fourth Jocelyn Herbert lecture by Walter Asmus, a close collaborator with Beckett. This year's students will curate a similar exhibition about Tony Harrison and his work with Jocelyn. The UAL and the National have established the first postdoctoral Jocelyn Herbert Research Fellowship, funded by the Ritstein Hopkins. And this will be a one-year full-time post and will initiate a programme of research into her influence and legacy. Sophie Jump, whose PhD at the UAL centred on Jocelyn's archive, has just achieved an unconditional pass, which, as those of you in academic life will know, is no small achievement. We're very happy to report that a recent visitor to Jocelyn's archive was the actor Sean Thomas. Tonight is a rare opportunity to hear an actor speak publicly about the work of the theatre designer. I'm only allowed a very short time for this introduction, so I can't talk more about Sean's very distinguished career, beyond saying that her perspective on tonight's event is unique, having been a member of a cast in plays written by Tony Harrison and designed by Jocelyn, and as an intimate friend of both of them. She is a first-hand witness to the remarkable fluid dialogue which began when Tony and Jocelyn first worked together on the National's now famous production of The Oresteia. Jocelyn's collaboration with Tony was a driving force in her last two decades, and it continued until the day she died in 2003, when Sean and Tony were with her at her Hampshire home. I can't tell you how pleased I am that Sean has agreed to give this lecture.
This summer, I was sitting in Delphi, Greece, thinking about how I should start talking to you tonight about Jocelyn, the great theatre and film designer, and who we're here to celebrate, and her extraordinary collaboration with my partner, the poet Tony Harrison. Tony and I were sitting having lunch under the plane trees opposite the now derelict Hotel Vouzas. It was in that hotel that Jocelyn first stayed in Delphi with George Devine back in the 1960s. George, who was half Greek, founded the Royal Court Theatre and was Jocelyn's partner for a number of years. Tony, who's from Leeds, was always told by the Greeks that he must have been a Greek in another life, and it was a Greek project, the Oresteia by Aeschylus, that first brought him and Jocelyn together in 1981 here at the National Theatre. From where we sit under the plane trees, I can see a statue of Aeschylus's Prometheus, commemorating the first production done in the ancient theatre of Delphi in modern times, Prometheus Bound, in 1927, directed and designed by the great Greek poet Angelos Sikelianos and his American wife, Eva Palmer. When I first came to Delphi in 1996, it was with Tony and Jocelyn. They were on a recce for Tony's film, Prometheus, which Jocelyn, Joss, was designing. The first place we went to on arriving was the Sikelianos house, where the couple had lived and which was now a museum. Inside, I can remember watching Joss and Tony avidly poring over the collection of designs and costumes of the 1927 Sikelianos production of Prometheus Bound, and Joss's eager curiosity at the hand-woven detail of the material Eva Palmer had used for the flowing garments of the Daughters of Ocean Chorus, and how exactly she'd gone about making the horned mask for Io, who is turned into a cow by Zeus. In some ways, Joss and Tony were very similar to the two Sikelianos, idealistic, imaginative, and yet very practical, highly skilled in their separate disciplines, but which could fuse together to create something quite unique. It was well into the 90 degrees Fahrenheit in Delphi in July, and I was wilting like the little English weed I was. But Joss and Tony had somehow turned native and were full of energy and light and a marvellous zeal and relish for whatever they could find or came their way. Thus it was I became initiated into the glorious way of being that they called going on a recce. I eventually had to go and lie down to cope with the heat, I remember, to my shame. I was in my early 40s at the time. Tony was about to turn 60, and Jocelyn was 79, I think. I left them still bubbling over with curiosity, life and ideas, opening a bottle of Retsina and making plans. Zeus let two eagles go in opposite directions, and immediately below where they met, halfway up Mount Parnassus, Delphi was created, the navel of the world, with its ancient temple of Apollo, theatre and stadium. Delphi is a very spiritual and creative place, and I began to understand just how special it was to both Joss and Tony, and realised the depth of their bond with it when I came there with them. I was in a unique position to see how they worked together there, and how it influenced their working relationship wherever they were. It was in Delphi that they did their next project together after meeting on the Oresteia, Trackers, or to give it its full title, The Trackers of Oxyrhynchus, first performed in the ancient stadium in Delphi in 1988. Trackers was an original piece based on fragments of an early satyr play by Sophocles, the Ichneutae. Satyrs were half goat, half man, with giant phalluses. I'd only met Tony in 1989, so only saw Trackers in 1990 when it opened at the National Theatre, the moment when 12 actors emerged instantly from 12 wooden crates as satyrs who burst into life after 2,000 years was electrifying in the Olivier. Apparently, it caused a sensation in the stadium in Delphi. The clattering of their clog dancing, brilliantly choreographed by Lawrence Evans, echoed off the twin rocky cliffs of the Phaedrides and caused mayhem for several minutes. Jocelyn had designed 12 wooden boxes or crates, each just big enough to contain one crouching actor. They were held together literally by string and simple eyelets, which the actors held crouched inside the boxes. As soon as they let go of the string, the boxes fell out flat, creating a fragmentary wooden dance floor on which the satyrs instantly did their wild, fantastic clog dance with all the pent-up energy of their 2 millennia confinement. This moment was typical of the way Joss and Tony would work. He first came up with the images of satyrs bursting out of crates before having written a word of the play. He'd done a little sketch of it. He showed this to Joss, whose imagination was immediately fired by it, and she came back with the mechanics of how it could be designed and done as simply as possible. Then Tony went off and began to write the play. Jocelyn has written, "A feature of working with Tony is that you get postcards, letters and phone calls from all over the world where he has been to a museum or seen a temple or a play or read a new book, which he has to communicate with you immediately in case it might be helpful." The other play, specially written and designed for Delphi by Joss and Tony, was The Labourers of Heracles, initiating the space on the mountainside in 1995, and which 10 years later became the newly built Theatre of the Cultural Centre of Delphi, inaugurated by Tony's Hecuba, starring Vanessa Redgrave. As you can see, the chorus this time for the Labourers of Heracles were 9 cement mixers with a 30-foot-high Heracles cement silo from which voices, sound effects and music emerged. I have so many memories of Joss and Tony in Greece working together, wrecking the ancient temple of Artemis in Elefsina, ancient Eleusis, for their Prometheus film, for instance. "Recces were our favourite part of the work, though we loved the work too," Tony has written. They were both of one mind, making drawings and writing notes in the ruined temple, delighting in the sudden juxtaposition of an ancient headless statue against which a giant chimney shot out a modern Promethean jet of flame from the nearby petrochemical works. They found a giant fennel stalk for testing back in London. They wanted to see if, according to the myth, it was possible for Prometheus to have transported the original fire that he'd stolen from the gods in a giant fennel stalk. Apparently, there are still old Greek fishermen who keep fire smouldering in fennel stalks for lighting their cigarettes. Joss did test it back in London in her studio, and the fire does stay contained, smouldering within the fennel stalk itself for a long time. This image eventually became the cigarette of the chain-smoking Prometheus figure in their film, an old retired Yorkshire miner. I came back to Greece in 1997 to meet Joss and Tony when they just finished filming the long journey of their Prometheus. It involved a 20-foot golden statue created out of melted down Yorkshire miners that became Prometheus, and its transportation all the way from Yorkshire to Greece, passing through Germany, Slovakia, Czech Republic, Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria. It finally arrived in Elefsina, Greece, birthplace to Aeschylus and the petrochemical works. A harrowing odyssey of some of the most polluted places in Europe, including Auschwitz and the carbon factory in Kopshamika, a modern legacy of the Promethean gift. When I found them in Elefsina at the end of 6 weeks filming on the road in as many countries, both Tony and Joss looked like mad, joyous gypsies, elated, tanned, and exhausted. Later, Tony wrote to Joss, "It was amazing. I've never felt more fulfilled or happy. I will treasure our days together as long as I live. You have given me so much, and I am deeply grateful." We went to spend a few days in Epidaurus to rest and relax with an old friend, Dionysios Fotopoulos, the Greek designer. His house was in the old town of Epidaurus and bordered literally right onto the sea. And this is a sketch of Tony by Jocelyn relaxing by the sea in Epidaurus. Every morning, Jocelyn and I would wake up and plunge straight into the turquoise blue sea and swim. Afterwards, we'd sit on the veranda, which was almost like the deck of a ship. It was so close to the sea. And Jocelyn would say, "I think it's ouzo time, darling. Don't you? And she and Tony and I would sit in the sun and have a very large ouzo at 10 o'clock in the morning. It became a catchphrase between the three of us, and somehow it was like an open sesame to their special world of serious creativity and sensuous relish. The last time we were in Greece with Jocelyn was in Delphi in 1998, a year after the filming of Prometheus, and the film was now being shown in various film festivals. We were standing on the ancient stage of the ancient theatre, the three of us, when we looked up, and there, high above us, we saw an eagle circling overhead. Joss was thrilled by it, and by the fact she'd managed the steep walk up to the ancient theatre at the age of 81. I thought of the original eagle sent by Zeus, and in Jocelyn's words, "And your spirit lifts with the wonder of being there." Soon after that, we suddenly had to leave Greece and go to Locarno in Switzerland, as Prometheus was going to be shown at the film festival there at very short notice. I'll never forget swimming that last day with Joss and her sudden terrible sadness as she looked back at the land and the mountainside. It was more like grief, really, at having to leave Greece. I think she felt it was the last time she would be there. And it was. "For the work and the work's sake only," is a quote from Samuel Beckett, close friend and colleague of Jocelyn's from the royal court days. "For the work and the work's sake only" encapsulates very profoundly both her and Tony's attitude to their work. They served a shared vision. Joss would always put the play and the text first, not her design. She was there very much, she felt, to enable the ideas and concept of the play and not the dictates of her own ego. When she worked with Tony, all the plays and projects, bar the one they met on, the Oresteia, which was directed by Peter Hall, all were written and directed by Tony himself, but in very close partnership with Jocelyn. They found it very freeing to work in this way without the attachment of a director. The vision could remain purer and more intact. What was extremely important to them was to know early on exactly what space the play was eventually going to be performed in, be it the Olivier, a Greek building site, or an ancient Roman amphitheatre. They would meet in her studio in Holland Park, where Tony would arrive with a bottle of Puy-Fumé or Sancerre in honour of Samuel Beckett's or George Devine's favourite tipple, respectively. And they would talk and play for hours with the model she'd have constructed of the space and or set, sometimes before much of the play itself had been written. She had an ability to share a vision, and without making it conventional, to find physical images to earth the lightning, Tony has written. So in a great sense, she was his muse as much as his designer. In some ways, they were not an obvious match. Joss was of a different generation, 20 years older, and from a genteel upper middle class background. Tony was working class Leeds, an urban angry young man. He still is, really, at the age of 78. But they shared a purity of vision in their approach and a fearlessness to go beyond the accepted norms in achieving that end. I think they both understood the Olivier space better than any other creative partnership because they loved the ancient Greek theatre it was meant to be based on and because they were not afraid of it or the freedom that it offered. Joss had an extraordinary way of seeing into the heart of a play and a space and releasing both by a kind of distillation or essence. Very like poetry in a way. One of her most beautiful designs for the Olivier was for Tony's play Square Rounds in 1992. It was about the history of chemical weapons. Not an easy subject, you might think, but Joss and Tony hit upon the metaphor of magic and colour to dramatise chemistry. She designed the whole of the Olivier stage to be like a giant top hat black on white, to echo the top hat of the conjurer and of the 19th century chemists, played by women, one of which, Justus von Liebig, was me. And I still have the bespoke three-piece suit that she designed for me. In Top Hat and Tails, we sang and performed magic tricks as Vesta Tilly-like cross-dressing music hall performers. But we sang about deadly gases and weapons. Huge coloured silks were released from the flies, transforming the space and performers in a single stroke. Yellow for mustard gas, green for chlorine gas, etc. It reminded me of the simplicity and vibrancy of a late Matisse. And when I first went to Jocelyn's house and studio, the first thing I saw was a giant print of Matisse's The Snail on her living room wall. If you haven't got yellow, use blue. A quote not of Matisse, but of Pablo Picasso. This was another maxim closely followed by both Joss and Tony, a very practical and sometimes radical way of coping with creative impasses. Most often put to use, I think, in what they would call their kamikaze productions. Kamikaze not in the sense of self-destruction, but a vivid and brave, single-minded commitment to the moment, wherever that might take them. These were productions not in conventional spaces, with only one or two performances, and often not in England, but Greece, Austria, Japan. Joss has written, "Working with Tony is not just putting on another play, it is a life-enhancing experience." She would ring Tony and say, "Any chance of a recce, darling?" Which meant, "When are we off on another kamikaze adventure?" And the one that I want to tell you about now is the one that drew most on their shared sense of originality, verve, and sheer sense of adventure. The Kaisers of Carnuntum. My story of the Kaisers of Carnuntum starts in Carnuntum itself, now a sleepy little town about 30 miles outside Vienna, Austria, and very near the Slovakian border and the River Danube. It is 1991, and Tony and I are at a symposium of ancient Greek theatre. Tony had taken trackers there the year before for the National Theatre Tour, and it had been hosted by the extremely enterprising Piero Bordin, artistic director of Art Carnuntum. Now he wanted Tony to do another piece, but specifically for Carnuntum. Tony agreed, provided it could be staged in the ancient Roman amphitheatre on the outskirts of the town. He knew that Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher king, had been the reigning Caesar there in Roman times. As Carnuntum had been a vital border town on the Danube, which divided the Roman Empire from the so-called barbarian lands. I remember Tony drawing his idea of having watchtowers around the edge of the arena on a napkin for Piero. These would draw a parallel with the all too real watchtowers that had existed just down the road on the border of Slovakia and Hungary, which of course had been under strict communist rule and had only recently come down the year before in 1990, following the collapse of communism in late 1989. Marcus Aurelius, who had written some of his most famous Stoic meditations in Carnuntum, had a son called Commodus, who was his exact opposite, a bestial killer whose lust for depravity and slaughter knew no bounds. He was known to dress in women's clothing and to kill 100 ostriches in the arena before lunch. The play would be about the conflict of brutality and civilization, both fruit growing on the same vine. The scholar-philosopher is father to the bestial gladiator. We can't ultimately separate them. We have to contain them and take responsibility for both sides of human nature. Tony had been irritated by the sign on the roadside pointing to the ancient Roman amphitheatre because it had a picture of the Greek tragic and comic masks as the emblem for theatre. Since it was Roman, It was not and never had been intended as a place for theatre and imagination, but only for snuff theatre, the real killing of prisoners by wild beasts and the slaughter of gladiators in mortal combat with each other. As Commodus says in the play, Greek bloodshed was all factor. Sorry, start again. Greek bloodshed was all fictor. Ours is factor. We Romans really kill the fucking actor. So, Tony wanted to reverse what the Romans had done and reclaim this ancient Roman amphitheatre as a place of life and imagination in the ancient Greek spirit of theatre as a means of bringing the dark back up to the light. The ancient ghosts of the past were going to be disturbed after 2,000 years of inactivity. They had to wait another 4 years, however, until 1995, before the intrepid Piero Bordin suddenly phoned to say that he had at last got permission from the archaeologists to use the ancient site. And so now, Tony and Jocelyn had their green light. Over the 4 years, Tony had done a lot of research and had had the usual creative discussions with Jocelyn about his ideas and the specific space of the ancient amphitheatre. They had even gone on a recce with Barry Rutter, who was to play Commodus, to Carnuntum, so Joss could see the space herself. It had involved a journey to the Czech Republic, where they had found a small travelling circus under the command of a gentle giant called Jaro Frank, who was a lion tamer and who had his own lions, tigers, and two wild bears, and could travel. So both Tony and Joss thought Jaro could be incorporated into the action of the play as Orpheus, poet and tamer of wild beasts. So he came on board. Jocelyn had had a brainwave regarding the set design of the ancient site. Tony had shown her a picture he'd seen in a children's book of a map of the Roman Empire that also showed the distribution of exotic animals that the Romans had captured and used to express their domination of the empire, all the wild animals eventually being brought back to the Colosseum in Rome for use in their blood sports and slaughter. And this is a picture of Jocelyn's design for the Roman world. She decided to make the entire stage floor of the arena into an enormous map of the Roman Empire in beautiful primary colours as in the children's book. Then in the very centre of the map, where Rome was situated, and underneath which was the ancient sump from which all the blood would have drained out into the Danube, she put a large model of the Colosseum. It was big enough to contain large lumps of meat, symbolising the exotic kills of the Romans, ostriches, giraffes, bears, elephants, etc. There was just room for Commodus to stand in it, and Orpheus, who delivers a final coup de grace at the end of the play, when the poet artist kills Commodus the tyrant with the spike of a white cello. Joss and Tony also discovered in the museum in Carnuntum ancient mosaics of Orpheus taming the beasts. These later became the main motif of huge hangings screening Jaro's lions, tigers, and bears from the audience before being suddenly revealed in all their roaring glory when the hangings were released. And this is a sketch by Joss of the arena with the towers and the lions. It had me more and more curious about the enterprise and not a little jealous, as I wasn't directly involved in the project. Tony had done everything now, except actually write the play. As I've said, often in his work with Joss, ideas and design would take root before the words were ready to be born. It was now overdue. I remember saying to him how I wished I could see it. I was very busy that year going from one job to another, and I was afraid I would miss it. And Tony saying, "You can only be really sure to see it if you're in it." And then proceeded to create the role of the Empress Faustina for me overnight. The introduction of the Empress Faustina seemed to be a catalyst for Tony to resolve and finish the play. She was the wife-stroke-mother, caught in the middle, holding the conflicting opposites, the saint-like father and the demonic son. Historically, the rumour was spread that she must have slept with a gladiator, hence explaining why she gave birth to such a monster. In the play, she intervenes when her husband and son are about to destroy each other, and her speech is a great elegy for all the mothers of tyrants throughout history. So, early the next morning, Tony sent me a fax of my dialogue and this wonderful long speech, all in rhyming verse. I rang Jocelyn, who immediately invited me over to look for a costume. I remember reading Faustina's speech on the tube, then showing it to Joss when I arrived in Holland Park, her saying, "What a marvellous speech!" and us both rushing off to the Portobello Road. In her wonderfully enthusiastic but utterly focused way, she soon found a silver-grey velvet tunic dress in an old Indian shop selling saris, and this became the basis of my costume. This is a picture of her fitting me. Then she unrolled a great bale of a vibrant burnt orange material and decided she could drape it round me to create my imperial robes. And this is the very material. I moaned that I'd just had all my hair cut off, very short and dyed red for a play. And she immediately found a beautiful bit of old costume jewellery on a stall and said she could make it into a little Roman coronet for my head, and found some cheap but lovely Indian earrings and a necklace to take the focus off my hair and onto my face and neck. Suddenly, in the space of a few hours, Faustina was beginning to appear before our very eyes. To celebrate, she took me off to a pub on the Portobello Road and we had sausages and white wine. Less than a week later, we all met at Heathrow to fly out to Vienna and so to Carnuntum to begin rehearsals. The other cast members were Conrad Nelson playing Marcus Aurelius, Lawrence Evans as secretary to Commodus, historically known as Julius Pollux, but Tony's Commodus called him Bollocks. And, of course, Barry Rutter as Commodus. Also Richard Blackford, who had composed some beautiful lyrical songs in a high falsetto for Marcus Aurelius to sing, and music for the choruses. When we arrived at the one little hotel in Carnuntum, the Hotel Marcus Aurelius, Jocelyn immediately turned her room into an impromptu wardrobe stroke design department and set about giving us all jobs to help with the enormous task ahead. She had made great headway with the costumes for the principal actors, including having taken Barry Rutter off to an Anne Summers sex shop in Soho to kit him out in an extra-large woman's corset, stockings and suspenders. Commodus was famous for dressing up as Hercules, who was known for his cross-dressing. But there were 300 Viennese, Slovak and Hungarian chorus extras yet to clothe, either policing the watchtowers in modern riot gear. She discovered how similar modern riot gear was to an ancient Roman centurion's armour, or as weeping women mourning the loss of their slaughtered sons. And we had to paint the gigantic set, the map of the Roman Empire. Because it was the great Jocelyn Herbert, word had spread, and some scene painters from the Vienna Bird Theater had volunteered their services too. So the first morning, we all set to work with long rollers, painting the white undercoat on the enormous canvas floor cloth spread out in the courtyard of the local Schloss or castle across the road from the hotel. The giant hangings screening the lions and tigers she made from simple Hessian sacking, with stencils of the mosaics of Orpheus from the local museum. Again, a Herculean undertaking. With 2 weeks to go before opening night, there was so much to do. Before the huge map of the Roman world could be put down in the amphitheatre, the whole floor of the arena had to be covered in sand and then flattened with a huge roller to make it absolutely level. The seating had to be erected, and the watchtowers put up with scaffolding around the circumference of the amphitheatre. And this is a photograph of how it looked at this point. I realise now, even more than I did then, what an extraordinary experience and privilege it was to be working with Jocelyn in this situation, where I was not just an actress, but a scene painter, prop maker, and seamstress, and was given a wonderful, intimate insight into how she worked. She was at the very heart of it all, focused and patient, quietly drawing everyone in like a magnet. One day, she and I went to Vienna to the famous flea market. She needed to find an old cello to paint white for Orpheus to kill Commodus with at the end of the play. We looked and looked, but we couldn't find one. And again, her practical but inventive approach was inspiring. She found an old guitar, decided she could shove a spike up it and paint it white, and voila, we had our cello. If you haven't got yellow, use blue. Gradually, things were coming together. However, we were still waiting for Yarrow to arrive with his little circus of lions and tigers and the bears. Meanwhile, the night of the terrible storm happened. Late May, in Austria, surrounded by huge chestnut trees in full bloom and the beautiful white cow parsley, Müllerbissel, that Jocelyn loved so much. And out of a clear blue sky, an apocalyptic storm descended on us and threatened to destroy the entire set and sound system that had been mounted high up on the watchtowers that surrounded the arena. It was as if the ancient ghosts of the place were not at all happy with our presence there. Everyone was up all night, desperately trying to bail out the rainwater as it beat down furiously on the tarpaulin covering the freshly painted map of the world. I felt doomed. I remember looking up at one point and seeing Tony in a cagoule, halfway up the tall scaffolding that held the speakers, like a crazed Captain Ahab up the rigging, battling with Moby Dick. And then seeing Jocelyn's calm but absolute determination as she bailed out her creation. And I thought, no, we will win. And we did. The storm eventually subsided, and the map of the world was saved by all hands on deck. Eventually, at the 11th hour, the day before the dress rehearsal, Yarrow turned up with his wild animals in tow. It was very exciting and rather unbelievable. At the end of the play, Marcus Aurelius had to process in his golden throne round the map of the world, pushed by a bear. So, of course, the bear needed a rehearsal. The moment when the bear suddenly stood up from four legs to two legs was both breathtaking and spine-chilling, like watching thousands of years of evolution in the twinkling of an eye. It stood 7 feet high, and apart from one moment when it suddenly lunged and demonstrated just how strong it was by dragging Yarrow with him, it actually behaved very well and pushed the golden throne with poor Conrad in it very obediently. As you can see. So the day of the first performance dawned. The joy of only having a first night and a last night means that everything is heightened and has a strange sense of occasion. I can vividly remember slowly walking down the ancient path into the arena, where gladiators must have walked 2,000 years before me, and climbing up into my throne, which had been erected among the audience, where I would sit and watch the play until my cue to stand and interrupt the action with my speech. And here I am. The pennants were fluttering in the breeze, and the evening sun was setting. It was packed with hundreds of people. The Viennese string quartet struck up, representing high art. Then Commodus entered to a sudden burst of machine gun fire, sirens and sweeping searchlights, like a pantomime villain, the epitome of low art, and we were off. Some people were offended at this juxtaposition and actually walked out when Commodus later appeared in his Hercules lion pelt and Anne Summers lingerie drag. Barry powered through it all, anarchic, outrageous, hilarious. I've never seen anyone with such bottle. The play, as some critics said, was both learned and earthy, and swung from lyrical beauty to broad, outrageous comedy to impassioned, tragic arias and back again. It was when the huge hangings were released, revealing the lions, that I could really sense a visceral wave of panic and excitement as people realised that not only were the animals real, but that their cages ran right underneath where they, the audience, were seated. The lions, so far, had been quite subdued, growling occasionally during the action of the play. I could hear my cue coming up, so I stood, and the lions began to roar. It was deafening and frightening, but I only had this one great speech, and I desperately needed them to be quiet. I literally summoned all my willpower and nerve and roared out my first line. Something communicated itself to those lions, and they stopped. Silence. Slowly, I did Faustina's speech. Later, one reviewer wrote, "Thomas and her fellow actors had a decibel duel with the lions." The lions, however, were a masterstroke. Soon we'd reached the end, and we all came down into the arena and took our bows. But the best moment of the night was walking back afterwards, down the avenue of giant chestnut trees laden with blossom and the white cow parsley nodding in the moonlight, just Tony, Jocelyn and myself, and hearing what seemed like hundreds of nightingales singing in the trees, serenading us all the way down the road, victorious, back to the Marcus Aurelius Hotel and a glass of wine. Having braved the lions, the nightingales sang. Reward indeed. And so came the last night hard on our heels. All went well, and the lions were relatively mute and well behaved, until near the end of the play, I had done my Faustina speech, and so was now backstage. I was aware of a sudden commotion around me. One of the bears had escaped. It had somehow got out of its cage and was roaming around in the dark, unbeknownst to the audience. The only person who could possibly catch it was Yarrow. And he was about to go on stage as Orpheus and kill Commodus with the white cello. He ran off to catch the bear, of course, and Tony was preparing himself to go on instead and appear as an alternative poet to Orpheus and perform the coup de grace. But at the very last minute, Yarrow reappeared, grinning, having caught the bear, and he went on. Talk about health and safety. The play finally ends with Tony coming on as himself, clutching his script, the poet author of the play, reclaiming the space for art, and is chased off the stage by Commodus, rising from the dead, roaring terrifyingly and scattering the script to the winds. The execution of one tyrant gives birth to the next. The production ran for only two nights and will probably never be seen again, but its message lives on, Irving Wardle wrote in the Times. And the Faustina speech was celebrated by being printed in full in The Guardian. The last night party was extraordinary. Tony spent his entire fee providing it. The cast and company, 300 singing extras, and the scene painters from the Berg Theatre, all in the little Marcus Aurelius Hotel, bursting at the seams with relief, laughter, wonder, and wine. A drinking song was introduced, which involved singing a simple song while lifting the long table up and down and drinking copiously at the same time. Eventually, it dissolved into laughter and applause. Then, as the noise died down, Joss could be heard very distinctly saying, "Oh, I liked that. Let's do it again. We were with her the night she died, a few years later, in 2003. We'd had the most wonderful day in her house in Hampshire, the old farmhouse she'd bought with George Devine. It was May, and the cow parsley that she loved was everywhere. We sat under her May tree, drinking Retsina in the sun, and talked about our kamikaze adventures, including the Kaisers of Carnuntum, of course. I remember she'd picked some yellow cowslips, and I'd picked a huge bunch of bluebells, and I thought of Picasso's saying, "If you haven't got yellow, use blue." And what a marvellously creative, almost subversive attitude to have towards life and art, which is what Jocelyn had. Later, she and Tony were talking about his latest play, Fram, set in the North Pole. And he said it would entail a very cold recce this time to the Arctic Circle. And she said, "How exciting!" Went upstairs and died. In my mind, I'm returning to our place under the plane trees, opposite the Hotel Vouzas in Delphi, where we sat this summer toasting Joss, and where I began to think about this lecture. As we lifted our glasses, I remember Tony saying, "She's gone ahead on a recce that we just can't join her on.